The title of Paul Auster's latest novel, 4-3-2-1, sounds like a countdown, but it actually refers to the four separate lives of its protagonist, Archibald Ferguson, as he grows up in post-war Newark, New Jersey, and tries to find out again and again who he is as a writer and as a person. Paul Auster is the award-winning and best-selling author of many novels, including Sunset Park, Invisible, New York Trilogy. His work has been translated into more than 40 languages, and I'm very pleased that this latest work, published by Henry Holt, brings him back to our show. Welcome back.
Good to see you, Leonard.
Can you talk a little bit about Archibald's family and the possibly apocryphal story about his grandfather?
Well, if you wouldn't mind, maybe I could just read the first paragraph
of the book.
Because this explains how Ferguson gets the name Ferguson.
That old Jewish joke?
It's an old Jewish joke, which I didn't know about until a few years before I started writing the book. And then I'll explain the reason why the name of the ship is what it is, because it's rather amusing. All right, this is the first paragraph of the novel. According to family legend, Ferguson's grandfather departed on foot from his native city of Minsk with 100 rubles sewn into the lining of his jacket, traveled west to Hamburg through Warsaw and Berlin, and then booked passage on a ship called the Empress of China, which crossed the Atlantic in rough winter storms and sailed into New York Harbor on the first day of the 20th century. While waiting to be interviewed by an immigration official at Ellis Island, he struck up a conversation with a fellow Russian Jew. The man said to him, "Forget the name Reznikov. It won't do you any good here. You need an American name for your new life in America, something with a good American ring to it." Since English was still an alien tongue to Isaac Reznikov in 1900, he asked his older, more experienced compatriot for a suggestion. "Tell them you're Rockefeller," the man said. "You can't go wrong with that." An hour passed, then another hour, and by the time the 19-year-old Reznikov sat down to be questioned by the immigration official, he'd forgotten the name the man had told him to give. "Your name?" the official asked. Slapping his head in frustration, the weary immigrant blurted out in Yiddish, "Ich hab vergessen," I've forgotten. And so it was that Isaac Reznikov began his new life in America as Ichabod Ferguson. So, The Empress of China is something I got out of Irving Howe's wonderful book, The World of Our Fathers, which is a study of Jewish immigration in New York City. In it, Howe tells of how the Yiddish papers in the city often scoured the American papers, the English language papers, for stories. But sometimes their English was less than perfect, as in this example. One of the reporters saw a headline in an English paper, and it said, "Empress of China coming to America on maiden voyage." And then the Yiddish paper printed a story that said, "Empress of China coming to America looking for a husband." So that's why I used it. Another misunderstanding about language and names.
Well, even though we are going through a time talking about immigration in a different way, most people, especially in New York, have immigrant stories.
Absolutely.
Did your family have an immigrant story?
Of course. There's one. Both sets of my grandparents came from Europe to the United States. There's a character that I refer to very glancingly in the book. It's a kind of distant relative of Archie's, and it's a real name. And this was one of my relatives. She had the exquisite name of Fagula Flagelman. That was who she was. And she was a girl from Warsaw. I guess she was probably in her early 20s when she hit Ellis Island. Apparently, she had an uncanny ability to learn languages. And so she knew 9 or 10 languages. And when the officials at Ellis Island found out about this, they hired her on the spot. And she spent her career as an interpreter for new Americans fresh off the boat. It's kind of moving.
Too bad she didn't meet Archie's grandfather. How would you describe Archie? Is he fundamentally the same person in all four versions of his life?
Well, this is it. The book is the story of, from birth to early adulthood, the story of a person named Archie Ferguson. But there are four of him, four parallel lives.
So one person has a number of different potentialities?
No, they're genetically the same person. They have the same parents. But in each version, the fortunes of the father are different. In one, he loses his money. In one, he's actually killed when Archie's just seven. In another, he becomes rich. They live in different towns. He has the boy has different friends. And so he develops differently. And I think of them... They all have a slightly different temperament. I would say number one is a slightly melancholic boy. Number two is a battler. Number three, the one who lost his father, is confused. A sweet boy, but very confused and prone to get into trouble. And number four is angry. He's in great conflict with his father. So they're all the same, but they're acting differently because of their different circumstances.
But they all want to be writers.
Yes, in different forms. Number one becomes a journalist and a translator of poetry. Number two, at a very early age, sets up his own newspaper. He's 11 years old. He has a one-sheet broadsheet. And number three becomes a film critic and memoirist. And number four is dedicated to the idea of becoming a writer of fiction.
He's an admirer of the German writer Heinrich von Kleist. You've said in interviews you also admire his work. The plays, the short stories, the novellas, the novels?
Well, there
Marquise
are...
of O?
Yeah, there are eight stories by Kleist. Two of them are quite long. Michael Kohlhaas is about 90 pages, and the Marquise of O is probably 60, and then the other stories are much shorter than that. I think what I like so much about Kleist, and I have Archie Four telling someone this, is the relentless telling. Kleist tells and tells and tells with a kind of propulsive energy, breaking all the rules that they have in American university workshops, the great adage, show, don't tell. Well, Kleist tells and tells and tells, and mostly,
it works perfectly fine.
It does. It really does. And I've mostly followed that advice throughout my life as a writer.
You also have references to some other writers, including your fellow Newarkian. Would that be the word?
Newarkian?
Somebody from Newark, Philip
yes.
Roth?
There's no reference to Philip in here.
No, there isn't?
Not a single one. No.
Oh,
there's some sometimes.
Maybe I was reading more into this than I should have.
No. I mean, I know Philip, and I like him very much. We've even speculated. He's about 15 years older than I am. We've speculated that when I was a little boy, he worked at a hot dog place near Weequahic High School called Sid's, a place where my father used to take me. And it's quite possible that one day the young Philip Roth served the young Paul, even younger Paul Auster, a hot dog. But no, there's not a single reference to him in the book.
Paul Auster's latest book is 4321. It's much longer than most of your previous works. Did you imagine that it was going to be longer from the start?
Yes, because of the structure. It's really, in effect, four novels in one volume. So I tried to keep it moving swiftly. I had...
With a complex structure here.
It's not that complex. It's simple once you get the hang of it. The story is told in rotating cycles. So you have the chapter, the first chapter is 1.0, which is a kind of prelude, and that tells the story of Ferguson's parents, how they met, how they married, and ends with him being born. And then the stories of the different Archies begin, 1.1, and then we have 1.2, and 1.3, 1.4, and then 2.1, 2.2, etc.
And how did you write them? Did you write each of the stories separately, or did you
write them? No, in sequence. First sentence, to the last sentence, all in order. I've never
been still in longhand. As
yeah,
you
yeah,
have
still in longhand. I've never been able to jump around as I compose, because what you write on page two, it might be something you weren't expecting to write, and then that will affect what you write on page 216. So if I wrote to page 216 first, it wouldn't be possible to know what to do on page two.
I mentioned that you've always talked about writing everything, at least the first draft, in longhand. Some of the sentences in this novel are quite long. I would have thought it would have been a lot easier to have written them on a computer.
No, I don't. I've never been able. I'm not against computers. It's just that I've never been able to compose on a keyboard, whether a typewriter or a computer. It's a quirk of my nature. I feel comfortable writing with a pen or a pencil in my hand. And then I work on the paragraph. I keep working on it, crossing out, redoing it, until it seems more or less finished. Then I turn around and type up that paragraph on my old manual typewriter. And then I can see it clearly. Then I start attacking that with the pen again. And that's pretty much how I compose a book, paragraph by paragraph.
So you're still one of the only people who doesn't work on a computer where you can still move sentences around.
I guess, but I certainly know a number of older writers who work on typewriters. And then I know a lot of poets who work by hand. So I don't think it's that unusual.
We started off talking about the immigrant story as the beginning. Can we describe this as an immigrant story of sorts? Do you think that novels about immigrants in America will change now that immigration has become such a major news story?
I don't know. I mean, all of American life is about immigration, isn't it? I mean, unless you are an American Indian, everyone came from somewhere else. And even the American Indians originally came from somewhere else. You can't talk about this country without talking about that. But essentially, this is not a book about immigration. This is a book about growing up in the immediate post-World War II era in the United States.
Some of my producers are wondering whether you send your editors a typewritten manuscript. Wouldn't they prefer a digital file?
Oh, but I go through another phase of this. Is I have a wonderful young woman who helps me out with all kinds of things. And one of the jobs she does for me is take my type scripts and rewrite them on a computer. So I have three manuscripts going simultaneously: the handwritten one, the typewritten, and the computer version. No, you have to hand in digital stuff to publishers. Those days of handing in type scripts are over.
Yeah, well, the way they read novels has changed as well.
I hope not too much.
Often the reviews of your work mention how popular you are abroad, but didn't you get into a bit of an international incident when you criticized the politics of Turkey?
Yes, this was 5 years ago, exactly 5 years ago.
Were you already working on this book?
No, this book I started about a year afterwards. For reasons that mystify me, I'm widely read in Turkey and have been for many, many years. Each one of my books goes through many printings.
In translation?
Yeah, in Turkish. And so I'm a known quantity there. It was my 65th birthday was looming, and I was publishing my autobiographical book, Winter Journal. And a Turkish journalist came to New York to interview me. And during the interview, I said, look, I want to make this very clear that I've refused invitations to Turkey because I'm protesting Erdogan's policies of jailing writers and journalists. Turkey is one of the worst offenders in the world in how it treats writers. I thought perhaps some pro-government columnist in a newspaper would write something attacking me. But no, indeed, it was the then Prime Minister Erdogan who got up and denounced me. in public. And then I came back the next day with a statement defending free speech, which was published in the Turkish newspapers. And then the next day, he denounced me again, and his party got up in parliament and said that I was an enemy of the Turkish state, in league with people like Angela Merkel and Sarkozy and the Kurds. Well, what are you going to do? I felt rather invigorated to be entering official senior citizenship on the week I was rattling the nerves of a head of state I don't like.
Well, he hasn't tried to link you with the attempted coup last year.
Not yet, but I'm not planning to visit Turkey anytime soon, I can tell you.
Well, there are, I'd imagine there are problems with any number of countries where you've been published, where if you say the wrong thing, I'm sure you have been published in Russia as well.
I've been published in Russia. I've been published in Iran, and I can tell you very interesting stories about that, because it is truly interesting. For years, Iran just simply pirated books. They didn't adhere to the Geneva Convention of Copyright. But in recent years, there have been a few who have tried to play by the rules, and I have one such publisher. And he explained to me that this was concerned with the publication of Sunset Park, so a book I published 2010, I believe. In that novel, there's a character who is working at American Penn in the Freedom to Write program. She's a graduate school with a graduate student with a job. And it's the moment of the Liu Xiaobo case in China. And also the fatwa against Salman Rushdie is mentioned, something that she experienced when she was a child. The publisher, who could only call me from Dubai, his phones are tapped in Tehran, but when he goes to Dubai, he can telephone me. And he said, look, you know, we have to change this. We can't say fatwa. We can't say Rushdie. And I said, well, then let's just not publish the book. I don't want to censor myself. He said, no, you don't understand. If I don't do it, someone else will do it, and they'll make a mess of it. So he said, but here in Iran, we have codes. So we know that this other word means Rushdie or fatwa, and people will know what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, people become very sophisticated writers in totalitarian
state, right.
Readers. But Paul Auster will be speaking to some very sophisticated New York readers with Bernard Schwartz, as well as doing a reading and signing books tonight at the 92nd Street Y. That's at 7:30. For ticket information, go to our show page at wmyc.org/lopate. The book 4321, published by Henry Holt.